from KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org, and URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Scott Schaefer. On today's show, we'll look at the governor's latest proposal to revamp education funding. And then we head to Oakland Unified to check out a new approach to student discipline. Suspending a troublesome kid clears the classroom, but in the long term, troublemakers need help to reform.
We're teaching these kids to actually say, when I did what I did, how did that make you feel? And why? I never thought about it like that. And I'm truly sorry.
Plus, enterprising volunteers are picking fruit from backyard trees to give to local food pantries.
It's so gratifying, and it's the kind of thing where you just kind of think, wow, yes, what a great idea. Why didn't somebody think about this sooner?
It's the California Report. We begin today with what could be the biggest education revolution in decades for California. Next week, Governor Jerry Brown is expected to propose a dramatic overhaul in the way the state spends money on education. A similar proposal fell flat last year, but education officials with the Brown administration have been tweaking the plan, and it may have more political support this time around. Anthony York of the Los Angeles Times got a sneak peek and joined us to talk about the details.
Right now, there's a series of antiquated formulas that have grown up in the wake of Prop 13, which was passed by California voters in the late 70s. There are vast inequities in the way schools are funded. And so the governor wants to direct more money into districts that serve students that cost more to educate, basically English learners and poorer students. And he also wants to give schools and districts more flexibility in how they spend billions of dollars that they receive every year from Sacramento. Right now, Sacramento has created more than four dozen specific programs that districts have to spend their money on. And the governor's argument is, look, this creates a crazy system. It's a bloated – first of all, there's a bloated school bureaucracy on the school level, on the district level, and on the state level to make sure all the money is being spent the right way. And also, districts don't have flexibility to spend money to deal with budget crunches. They have to spend a certain amount of money on technology. They have to spend a certain amount of money on whatever the program is. And like I said, there's dozens of them. And so the governor wants to give the locals a little bit more control.
Well, let's dig into this. I mean, what kind of rules are we talking about that are antiquated? I'm given to understand computers are a good thing to have in schools, that limiting class sizes, it's a good idea.
That's it, right, and that's a big one. But the question is, should districts have a little bit of flexibility? If they can get good results, say spending money on, you know, maybe a class size is 23 instead of 20, and that allows the district to purchase updated materials, for example, if that's the way the district sees fit, then the governor believes that the district should have the flexibility to do that.
And they don't have that flexibility now?
Some of that they don't. I mean, they've been given some temporary flexibility to deal with the budget crunch over the last few years. The class size program, for example, has been suspended, and that's why we've seen class sizes go up in kindergarten through third grade classes around the state over the last 3 or 4 years. But one of the big things to watch in this is going to be the accountability. I mean, districts are given flexibility, but on the back end, they're still going to have to produce results. And what those accountability measures look like is going to be a big part of the fight in the legislature this year.
So is it fair to say that these rules that districts have to comply with to get state funding, the legislature came up with them, and so what the legislature giveth, it can taketh away?
Right. The last time that we saw a little uptick in state revenues in the middle part of the last decade, the legislature in 1 year created more than two dozen of these what they call categorical programs, these specific programs, so that schools get money, but they have to spend it on a specific program. The governor believes that we're on the brink of an uptick in state revenues, and so the idea is that as that happens, all schools will get more money. You know, as state revenues rise and schools get about 40% on the natural of all those revenues, but that as those revenues increase, that a larger share is just directed to the places that serve poorer students.
Would you describe this as a big change, a sea change in the way education would be funded in California, or is it really more of a set of tweaks?
No, this is a big change. I mean, the governor's own education advisors are calling this the most fundamental change in the relationship between the state and school districts since the passage of Proposition 13. So this is a big deal. And certainly there are a lot of people who are invested in the status quo and are concerned about the change. While they support the idea, I can't tell you how many times in the course of reporting the story that ran this week, I think I cut it off at about 24 when I heard people say the devil is in the details. For the governor, I think it's in part a philosophical issue of how much of a say and how much control should emanate from Sacramento, what kind of a basic sort of statewide standard do you need, and how much do you allow these districts and these individual schools to be sort of laboratories for experimentation of different kinds of learning, because not every student learns in the same way. And so, you know, it's an open question, and it's one that I think a lot of educators wrestle with, and it's one that the governor and his top aides are wrestling with as well.
Anthony York covers Sacramento for the Los Angeles Times. A number of new education laws in California tackle a particularly alarming issue. Our schools now issue more suspensions to students than diplomas, especially to African American students. Nowhere is that more apparent than in Oakland Unified. The California Report's education reporter Anna Tantakalos tells us district officials are pinning their hopes on a new approach to student discipline called restorative justice.
It's a cold and rainy day at Ralph Bunche Continuation High School. The small campus is located in a gritty, industrial part of Oakland. Teenagers are sent to this school if they've gotten expelled, suspended, or if they've served time in jail. Teacher Eric Butler greets me behind the steel gates at the campus entrance and leads me to his classroom.
All right, so this is going to be a good class. Fourth period.
Butler is the restorative justice coordinator here. It's his job to bring out the good in the district's most persistent troublemakers. Today, he's introducing the restorative justice concept to about 10 students who've gotten kicked out of school for everything from wearing their hat backwards to fighting in the classroom.
Who knows what restorative justice is? What does it mean to restore something?
Bring new.
Bring back, fix, make new. Who knows what justice is? That's a harder question.
These students come from tough backgrounds where there's gang violence, drug abuse, and dysfunctional families. Butler says these are the key reasons why students act out in school. His restorative justice class, or RJ for short, gets kids talking about problems in their lives and what's behind their bad decisions.
So one of the main parts of restorative justice is forgiveness. So that's what we're going to be talking about first, forgiveness.
At first, the kids are bored, but things change when Butler asks whether it's okay to forgive a man if he hits a woman. Immediately, everyone wants a chance to speak.
Listen, time out. One of the things that we're going to learn in the classroom is, no matter how shocking, we're going to learn how to let them speak.
Butler then turns to one of the more outspoken girls, who says she can understand why a man hits a woman. It shows he cares.
The way we grow up, if you love your girlfriend, you probably put your hands on her or whatnot. This is just a simple check. Like, you check a kid, you check her too, you feel me? Because that's what some of these girls need, is somebody to show them some affection.
Half of the students disagree and shout out that it's never okay to hit a woman. Butler says it's discussions like these that help kids re-examine their attitudes, their actions, and the consequences of their behavior.
We're teaching these kids to actually say, when I did what I did, how did that make you feel? And why? I never thought about it like that. And I'm truly sorry. And that's way harder than going home for 3 days so you can smoke weed.
Until recently, the vast majority of students suspended in Oakland were African American, even though they make up just 35% of the district's student population. When the U.S. Office of Civil Rights investigated this racial disparity, the district was forced to address the problem. So now Oakland Unified has committed to a 5-year district-wide plan requiring all schools and teachers to use restorative justice practices rather than punitive discipline.
So the difference between punitive and restorative is really the difference between doing to and working with.
David Yusa manages Oakland Unified's restorative justice program. He points to research that shows suspended students are 5 times more likely to drop out of school and 3 times more likely to enter the juvenile justice system. Yusa says that's a huge waste of human potential and human capital.
There's something about the way we do discipline that is not working for our African-American students. And so it's up to us to serve the students, not to the students to fit into some sort of what I would consider, you know, sort of old model of education. And so this requires really a whole culture shift.
And Yusim says that begins with teacher training, which is slowly rolling out throughout the district. Student advocate Laura Fair says that training must address the reality of racial bias that exists in classrooms around the state.
If you're an African-American student, you're going to be suspended at a much higher rate.
She says schools are abusing the state's zero-tolerance policy that was intended to address problems like weapons on campus. Now Fair says students are getting kicked out for even minor offenses.
Tapping on the desk, for talking back, for wearing the wrong clothes, for any number of things that you could imagine. And sometimes it really does depend on, does that teacher like that student or is that administrator like that student? So we have some really subjective discipline happening. And when we know it doesn't work, to be doing that is really counterproductive.
State lawmakers have taken action with a series of laws designed to curb the state's high suspension rate. One measure urges California school districts to try programs like restorative justice before suspending students. But some teachers, like Oakland Unified's Benji Achtenberg, says those programs should not replace suspensions.
If a student needs to be removed so everybody else can continue to carry on with the lesson and what they're supposed to be getting out of class that day, then that would happen.
Achtenberg says while he supports the goal of restorative justice, the district is not providing enough resources and training to help teachers who are already overwhelmed.
It takes a lot of time and a lot of energy, and without enough support, you know, one single classroom teacher can't do it. No matter how awesome they are at everything they do, there needs to be much more of the community buy-in, staff buy-in, and student buy-in.
But Oakland has already seen some success. In schools that use RJ practices, suspension rates are down and attendance is up. Back at Ralph Bunch Continuation High School, students like Gary Holt say they're doing better in class because of the restorative justice program. Holt used to get kicked out of school almost every other week and spent a year in juvenile hall. Now he's earning A's and B's.
I'm doing good, though. You know, I'm doing better than I ever did. I mean, but that's because I really didn't apply myself. It was like I didn't even do it.
Holt says now he understands more about himself and how his actions affect other people.
Then it was I had a crew for negative things, you know, leading them in negative ways. Now I try to do it like in a more positive way.
If Oakland does succeed with this new approach to student discipline, the district could set an example for the rest of the state and help a lot more students like Gary Holt. For the California Report, I'm Anna Tentakulis.
Volunteers with the nonprofit Food Forward take the old adage, waste not, want not, to heart. Every week, they visit backyards across Southern California to salvage fruit for food pantries. KPCC's Stephanie O'Neill recently visited a fruit pick in Granada Hills and filed this report.
We need more ladders, yeah. We're working without ladders.
On a recent Sunday morning, more than 60 men, women, and children with metal ladders and garden tools spent 3 hours picking Valencia oranges from the backyard trees of 8 homes in Granada Hills. The volunteers with the nonprofit group Food Forward climbed under, up, and into the unkempt trees, dodging sharp branches and thorns to save thousands of pounds of fruit from wither and decay. Their goal? To box it for local food pantries that serve the needy. Darielle Doyle of Manhattan Beach is on her third Food Forward pick.
The hard part is actually navigating through all of these branches to try to, you know, get to the fruit. And then we have the extension that you can put on the grabber picker so that you can get the fruit up in the higher branches. And then we have ladders as well to really get way up there.
It's a lot of physical work here.
It is, but it's so gratifying. And it's the kind of thing where you just kind of think, wow, yes, what a great idea. Why didn't somebody think about this sooner? You know, all of this food going to waste, and now you know that it's going to people who can really use it.
Among them, food banks, homeless shelters, and homebound AIDS patients.
We also are now donating to close to 30 agencies across Southern California. We started with one.
It was about 3 years ago that Food Forward founder Rick Namias noticed an abundance of ripe fruit hanging from trees in his neighborhood.
I had a dog that was getting older, and as we took longer, slower walks, I became more aware of my surroundings and more aware of that every other tree in my neighborhood of Valley Glen had either an orange tree, a grapefruit tree, walnuts, pecans, pomegranates, and that almost 100% of that was going unused.
Namias posted a Craigslist ad asking for volunteers. Within 3 weeks, he and those volunteers picked and donated 800 pounds of tangerines and oranges from just 2 trees in a friend's backyard. These days, an online counter keeps tally of Food Forward's crop yields.
We've now harvested or rescued over 250,000 pounds. It's pretty crazy. I mean, in a food pantry world, that's almost 2.5 million servings of fruit that otherwise didn't exist before.
We're really fortunate to be able to offer fresh and healthy food like this.
Richard Weinroth is food bank director and chef at mendpoverty.org in the San Fernando Valley.
For a long time, food banks were seen as only providing canned food, dry goods, but we go through about 50,000 pounds a week of fresh fruits and vegetables at the food bank at Mend, and Food Forward's a big part of what we get to offer.
And the people who own the trees get a tax write-off for the harvested fruit. Fran Penn says for 40 years, the trees at her Granada Hills home always produced far more than she could pick and bag for her friends.
I would gladly pick it because it's such good fruit. It's a waste. And then it'd be raked up and thrown in the garbage.
Rebecca Jarris says she and the other volunteers also throw out fallen or rotten fruit that attract rodents. Others prune the trees.
There's a lot of dead branches. The branches really need to be trimmed on some of these very mature trees, and they don't get to them because older folks live here and they just don't have the energy to keep their trees up. So we do what we can while we're here.
You feel a sense of accomplishment when you get done with a tree.
Rebecca's husband, Scott Jarris, is a Food Forward board member and a weekend picker.
And as you're driving away, you notice that you got one tree out of like 100 of them. And you feel like you want to just come back and keep picking and picking and picking. There's just so much produce in the valley here that it's just impossible to get to it. But, you know, we're making a good dent in it, if you will.
Indeed they are. On this morning, Food Forward volunteers picked and boxed nearly 4 tons of oranges for Mend Poverty's San Fernando Food Bank. For the California Report, I'm Stephanie O'Neill.
Great work. Here comes the men truck. So those of you able-bodied men who can help Rich load these boxes up, that'll be great.
This week, our occasional series on California songs continues with Chris Bryden, lead singer of the San Francisco Bay Area band Alma Desnuda. The name means naked soul in Spanish. Bryden spoke to us about their song 2 Days, 3 Nights, which was written after the band members quit their day jobs and became full-time musicians.
California was our playground, our backyard, as it were, as we first started touring, you know, leaving the Bay and maybe taking a trip up to Sacramento, or our first trip to LA, Chico, and the landscape of California. We're all from California, and it's just shaped so much of our music, who we are, and really was the backdrop for the story, the song 2 Days, 3 Nights.
Well, it's been 2 days and 3 long nights. Situations come and everybody's fly. Hey, girl with the long hair, I must be moving on. I see on through again.
What inspired it really was the phrase, 2 days, three nights. And that seemed to encapsulate so much about what we were doing at that point in our careers. We were, and we still really are, living really hard, going and playing lots of shows, a lot of late nights, a lot of early mornings. Every night is a new town, a new place, new people. And I think the song speaks to that spirit, that funness, the freedom, the California. It evokes a beach for me. It evokes ocean. It evokes wind and the hair and fun, lightheartedness.
What has been 2 days and three long nights? We've been playing lots of music. Now our summer's on the five. Straight down the west side. California, hang your head high. You see, I'm coming home again. And oh, to be free.
Every time we come back to California is the best time. Landing on the tarmac at SFO, coming over the Altamont Pass back to the Bay Area, the air, the sunshine, the people. There's something that is hard to pinpoint about what California is, but it's so much a part of us. It's what we feel and resonate as home. It's where we've grown up and where we will always come back to.
California, hang your head high. You see, I'm coming home again, my.
That's Alma Desnuda's Chris Bryden on their song 2 Days, Three Nights from the 2011 album Riders. You can find the rest of our California songs at californiareport.org. Model trains are magic, especially when somebody has gone to the trouble of building an expansive system. You can't help but feel awe and a kind of childlike wonder at the sight of a miniature line going full bore with lights flashing and horns blaring. KQED's Rachel Dornhelm has the story of one man with a particular passion born from his childhood experience clear across the country.
This is a love story. It's about my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
Nostalgia.
Yeah.
And New York City's rail system, especially the subways.
First stop on the New York Central. First stop.
My name, Richard Dornhelm, and I'm a civil engineer by training, and I'm a Brooklyn boy by birth.
120-50.
We never had a car. We had a subway, and we took the subway to my grandma's house, or we took the subway to museums, took the subway to Coney Island. We took the subway just about everywhere we went.
When he was little, he and my Uncle Mark always stood at the front of the first car, where they'd look out the huge front window as the trains barreled down the track.
There wasn't much to see in a tunnel. So it was really the anticipation that this thing would take you somewhere and you would come out of this hole in the ground and you'd be in a very different place, a new world.
New York!
My dad lived in Brooklyn, the Church Avenue stop on the F line, until he finished college. He ultimately landed in California, where he met my mom, who also grew up near the Church Avenue stop. When I was growing up, he only rode the subway when we went to visit family. And then, 15 years ago, he went to a railway museum near Sacramento, and there he found some of the original 1880s steam-powered cars that ran on Manhattan's elevated tracks.
A few, actually, two, were saved, and they ended up in a museum in Rio Vista.
The two cars survived because they'd been sold for use in the Kaiser shipyards in Richmond, across the bay from San Francisco.
Over here in Contra Costa County, and they continued to work during the war years, World War II, taking shipyard workers between the yards and Richmond.
After seeing those cars, my dad went home and started thinking about how to model them by hand, remembering subway modeling he'd done as a teen.
from that, I just decided, well, if I built that car, there was a companion car and there were
You can see where this is going.
And then there was the second subway, the BMT. And
now, my parents' living room in an otherwise simple 1970s tract home in Walnut Creek is like a New York City rail yard.
I never intended to end up with 100 cars.
The cars are about a foot long, of all colors and eras. They've won awards and run in the New York Transit Museum's holiday show at Grand Central. There are antique-looking ones with paneled wooden sides and tiny bare light bulbs, and shiny new models, the stainless steel cars I remember riding.
People don't look at subways the same way I do.
How do you look at them?
Well, I think they're a marvel of ingenuity, and even if they are a hole in the ground, it still has really produced enormous benefits for the people in the cities. Oh, you're on the right track. Here we come.
Take all of
Watch your hand.
Go!
My daughters and my niece love them, driving them around the room on a mock elevated track he built. It's hard to imagine they understand the hundreds of hours of work some of these incredibly detailed, built-from-scratch trains represent.
I am in the city riding on a choo-choo train, say choo-choo.
But they are learning all kinds of New York history. They know the turquoise and white cars were built for a World's Fair. The 1930s Green Hornet was made of aluminum and shaped like a BART train, but was scrapped for the war effort. My dad even modeled some freight cars that ran under the elevated tracks making deliveries. One is a bright orange refrigerator car from the 1950s.
The doors would open and people from the neighborhood would go up and buy crates of wine-making grapes. Largely an Italian neighborhood. I remember I first heard about California because those orange refrigerator cars were from this place called California. Wonderful place, I thought. Too bad the subway doesn't go there.
Over the holidays, I watched my dad sanding wood in his workshop, which used to be my room. His father was a toolmaker, and my dad uses some of those tools as he works. I'm struck by how much these models bring together. My dad and his father, our families in California and Brooklyn, my dad's childhood with his grandkids. I can't help but admire the car's artistry as we look at them. He reminds me some of them will be mine someday.
Yeah, I hope they'll be a source of joy for you and your brother. You don't have to keep them all. You can just pick a few and remember the subway and remember me. What else can I say?
For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
We've got photos and video online at californiareport.org. And that's The California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us online at californiareport.org, and of course we're on Facebook. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Paul Lancour and Jim Bennett. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Rachel Johnson and Catherine Borgeson, who produced our California song. Pat Flynn and Dan Brecky were contributing editors this week. Special thanks to Andy Lansett of WNYC New York Public Radio and the New York Transit Museum for archival audio. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, health happens with prevention at calendow.org. And Chevron, committed to helping California grow by supporting small businesses and investing in education.
More information available at chevron.com.